It's time for Security Now. Steve Gibson is here. We have a, I would say, a potpourri show. Everything from a silly riddle to the original diagram of Ethernet from 1973. And a surprisingly young picture of Steve Gibson from 1984. That and a lot more, including an analysis of the WannaCry aftermath. All coming up next on Security Now.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Security Now is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. It's time for Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 613, recorded Tuesday, May 23rd, 2017. WannaCry Aftermath. Security Now is brought to you by Carbonite. Keep your business safe this year. Protect your business from ransomware and hacker attacks with the automatic cloud backup from Carbonite. Try it free at Carbonite.com. Don't forget to use the offer code SecurityNow to get 2 free bonus months if you decide to buy. And by the Ring Video Doorbell. With Ring, you can see and talk to anyone at your door from anywhere in the world using your smartphone. It's like caller ID for your home. Go to ring.com/security now and get up to $150 off a Ring of Security kit. And by Cloudflare. More than 6 million websites, apps, APIs, and SaaS companies use Cloudflare's services to weather whatever the internet throws at them. For a free online chat session with a Cloudflare support engineer, get all your questions answered, visit cloudflare.com/twit. It's time for Security Now, the show where we cover your security and privacy online, rapidly becoming the most popular show on our network. And I have to credit this guy right here, our security guru, Steve Gibson of the GRC Corporation. We were at Hi, Steve.
Hey, Leo. Great to be with you.
We were at the Maker Faire.
Oh, doesn't that look like fun? I was just drooling looking at those at all of the stuff there.
Well, a lot of people came by to say hi, and to a person, they said, "You want to know what my favorite one is?" And I said, "Yeah, I guess." Security Now. They all love Security Now. Maybe it's because it's the geekiest show we do. Makers like Security Now, I guess. Anyway, take it for what it's worth, a data
point. Thank you. Yeah. I appreciate the feedback.
I love the show, that's for sure.
That's great.
And today we're going to WannaCry some more.
Oh, well, there's naturally, there's been lots of, you know, with anything as big as WannaCry, it doesn't just end, you know, like last Tuesday when we did the show and sort of pronounced it done. There's more. So as I was pulling everything together, I realized about half of what we had to talk about was still WannaCry. So the first half of the podcast we'll discuss the aftermath and various things. Like there have been claims that there's a way to decrypt it. There's questions about does it actually infect XP, and even some interesting reporting. I think it was from the Washington Post. We'll get there in a second about the NSA's position on this. Which, and I've got some interesting feelings about that as well. So we'll examine a bunch of WannaCry follow-ups, including some new background, reports of the ability to decrypt drives, attacks on the kill switch, and more. We'll also look at what the large Stack Overflow site had to do in order to implement HTTPS. It's a beautiful sort of case in point of a big, sprawling, complex site and how it turns out not to be as simple as just using Let's Encrypt. Then there's an interesting question about the Wi-Fi security of various properties owned by the current U.S. president. And you can imagine it's not good. In fact, it's very worrisome. And speaking of worrisome, there's news coming from the UK's Theresa May about the continuing plans. The headlines are odd. They talk about the UK wanting to create a new internet, and it's like, what? And then you know, which is like a strange headline. But it turns out what they're wanting to do is to basically really put the screws to the internet that we have. And so what the people doing the headlining were trying to imply was it's so onerous that it's a different internet. It wouldn't be like the one we have now.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. I also want to talk about the still sorry state of certificate revocation, which, of course, we dipped into deeply a few years ago when I realized what Chrome was not doing. And I created the revoked.grc.com domain specifically to demonstrate and allow users to test the revocation awareness of their browsers. The revoked.grc.com domain is a deliberately revoked certificate. And the question is, can your browser go there or not? And Chrome just happily does, even today. But there have been additional movements that I want to sort of catch everybody up on. Then the question of whether SSDs are also subject to Rowhammer-like attacks. And some research suggests that there are two different types of attacks that can be employed against SSDs to damage them deliberately. And then, of course, we've got some miscellany and some closing the loop with our listeners. So I think another jam-packed, information-laden podcast.
Of course. I expect nothing less for you, my friend. Let's take a break. We have three sponsors today, so we better get to it. And, of course, couldn't be a more appropriate sponsor for this first segment, Carbonite. If you're worried about WannaCry, you don't have to cry. Carbonite is here for you. Don't let ransomware of all kinds affect you. Go to Carbonite.com. It's online backup done right with versioning. In fact, if you check out the office plans, you will see a huge variety of really good plans, including hardware on-premises backup that then syncs to Carbonite, high availability plans, all for a very affordable price. And if you go to the resources page, a lot of great, useful white papers, including how to fight ransomware, how, you know, WannaCry can impact you and how you can avoid it. Even things like how to comply with HIPAA regulations, how other businesses use Carbonite. There's lots of great information there. But in particular, that very timely, lots of information about ransomware and how Carbonite can keep you safe. A good backup is really your first line of defense for all kinds of problems. Carbonite is automatic. It's continuous. Whenever you're online, it's backing up. They have plans for home and office, Mac and PC. Of course, it's the office plans that are really important these days because ransomware could put you out of business. All that data on your computer, the accounts receivable, the customers list, the suppliers list, all of that, your financial records are on your computer. And if it takes you a week to get back up, that's a week of lost business. High availability solutions mean you won't be down for long at all. Carbonite's got solutions for every business. Just check it out at Carbonite.com. And try it free. No credit card required. Do use the offer code security now. That does two things. First of all, lets them know you heard it on this show. That helps us. But it also gives you 2 months free if you decide to buy. You got to back it up to get it back. And in these days of ransomware and malware and all sorts of threats, Carbonite's the solution. Carbonite.com. Don't forget the offer code security now. I've got your picture of the week ready to go, Steve.
So, yes. Yesterday, Bob Metcalf, the inventor of Ethernet, tweeted that it was the 44th anniversary of his invention of Ethernet. And so our picture of the week, he also included in his tweet, was a hand-drawn, because this was 1973. This was the year I graduated from high school.
Wow,
he was inventing.
Wow.
He was inventing, yes. He was at the Xerox Park, the Palo Alto Research Center, PARC. And so this was his hand-drawn note. And I was going to say that back in 73, you know, we didn't have like
you didn't have Visio or Trello or anything. You got to
exactly.
This is a napkin, my friends.
Exactly, and so he did a. He had a typewritten description of it, but he needed a graphic to go with it.
Wow.
And I just love this picture because in the upper left, he shows like a bunch of Altos, which was the GUI workstation, which Steve Jobs famously saw and said, okay, that's the way you do these things. He has this sort of this kind of stick figure looking network with Altos hung on to it in different places. There's a Dynabook. There's a Nova, which was a popular mini computer of the day. There's a PDP-11. And then he has it labeled with an arrow pointing to it, a cable tree ether, meaning a cable tree conductive medium. And then in the second diagram to the lower right, he shows again a cable ether and then what he calls a telephone coax booster with a pair of copper lines.
Wow.
And he points to it saying that that's a telephone ether. And then he's got a wacky little thing that the telephone ether connects to that says telephone radio booster, and a little looks like a cactus, but it's meant to be a radio antenna sticking up. And that's his radio ether. So, I mean, he foresaw Wi-Fi back in 1973. I mean, this is exactly what we have today. And I will come back to this in our miscellany because I want to talk about the conceptual leap that he made, that he had to make, and why it was so different than the solutions of the time, and how very much like the original concept of the internet, which we've discussed before, how counterintuitive it was that you could autonomously route packets with no guarantee for their delivery. That is, the system itself couldn't guarantee delivery, but it just made a best effort, and how that was enough to revolutionize the world's communications. And so this is sort of a small down at the connectivity part, but it's a similar innovation. So anyway, just a neat photo this week. I'm so glad that Bob gave me the opportunity to talk about it. And he and I have met on a number of occasions. He's a great guy and an engineer's engineer. So the first thing I wanted to note was, and it was the Washington Post, had some interesting coverage and some background about the NSA's reaction to and feelings about the loss of their control over this very potent hacking tool, which was turned into, as we know, this WannaCry worm. The Washington Post writes, when the National Security Agency began using a new hacking tool called Eternal Blue, those entrusted with deploying it marveled at both its uncommon power and the widespread havoc it could wreak if it ever got loose. Some officials even discussed whether the flaw was so dangerous they should reveal it to Microsoft, the company whose software the government was exploiting, according to former NSA employees who spoke on the condition of anonymity given the sensitivity of the issue. But for more than 5 years, the NSA kept using it through a time period that has seen several serious security breaches. And now the officials' worst fears have been realized. The malicious code at the heart of the WannaCry virus, which we actually know is a worm, that hit computer systems globally late last week, was apparently stolen from the NSA, repackaged by cyber criminals, and unleashed on the world for a cyber attack that now ranks as among the most disruptive in history. The failure to keep Eternal Blue out of the hands of criminals and other adversaries casts the NSA's decision in a harsh new light, prompting critics to question anew whether the agency can be trusted to develop and protect such potent hacking tools. Current and former officials defended the agency's handling of Eternal Blue, saying that the NSA must use such volatile tools to fulfill its mission of gathering foreign intelligence. In the case of Eternal Blue, the intelligence haul was unreal, said one former employee. Quote, it was like fishing with dynamite, said a second. The NSA did not respond officially to several requests for comment for this article. And then the story goes on to reiterate a bunch of back that we've already discussed. And as I said last week, I understand that this is an extremely tough call. My feeling is it's easy for those on the sidelines to jump up and down and say that the NSA should not secretly develop and then keep secret such powerful vulnerabilities. But I think it's very important to note that this is that what is unfortunately missing from all of the reporting of this story are any details as a function, I mean, as a consequence of the nature of the fact that they have to be kept secret, of what the use of this long-standing SMB Windows vulnerability may have been to U.S. national security during the time that it was both available for the NSA's use and secret. We don't know how useful it was. You know, we quoted, or the Washington Post quoted that comment saying that the intelligence haul was unreal. But we have no details. We don't know what valuable intelligence it may have uniquely allowed to be gathered. And of course, had that been patched, that asset, that powerful intelligence gathering asset would have been killed. So horrific as its escape doubtless was, maybe if we knew how our intelligence services had been able to use its unique powers during the time of its availability, we might feel differently. But we're unlikely to know one way or the other. My only point here is to observe that we do not have the benefit of the full story. We don't know what it might, we don't know that it might change our judgment if we did know. So I thought, I appreciated the Washington Post reporting on that and a little hint that it really was such a powerful tool. And on the heels of this comes the proposed Patch Act, a new bill designed to prevent occurrences like WannaCrypt. And I'll explain what it is and give some background and why I think it's a total crock. Okay, so Security Week reported on this, and it was picked up from additional coverage, but basically a repetition of what is known, which is, you know, there is a bill now. So Security Week writes, following the worldwide WannaCrypt ransomware attack that leveraged the Eternal Blue exploit developed by and stolen from the NSA, Microsoft's chief legal officer, as we discussed last week, and quoted Bill saying, called for governments to stop stockpiling zero-day exploits. His arguments are morally appealing but politically difficult. Now, however, writes Security Week, he has partial support from a bipartisan group of lawmakers. And there's a bunch of them. Senators Brian Schatz, who's a Democrat from Hawaii, Ron Johnson, a Republican in Wisconsin, Cory Gardner, Republican from Colorado, and U.S. Representatives, those are senators, U.S. Representatives Ted Lieu, Democrat in California, Blake Fahrenthold, Republican in Texas. Schatz announced yesterday that they had introduced the, quote, and this is where PATCH is an acronym, actually, Protecting Our Ability to Counter Hacking Act.
Oh, please.
I know.
They must spend more time on that than the actual bill. I swear to God.
I know. Well, just wait, because, I mean, it's so useless of 2017. Its purpose is to establish a Vulnerability Equities Review Board.
That already exists. Obama set that up. Didn't work.
Exactly. With permanent members, including the Secretary of Homeland Security, the Director of the FBI, whoever he is, the Director of National Intelligence, the Director of the CIA, the Director of the NSA, and the Secretary of Commerce, or in each case, a designee thereof. Its effect will be to seek a compromise between the moral requirement for the government to disclose vulnerabilities, you know, and then in parens, Security Week writes Microsoft's Digital Geneva Convention, and the government's political expediency in stockpiling vulnerabilities for national security and deterrence purposes. In a statement issued yesterday, Schatz wrote, quote, striking the balance between U.S. national security and general cybersecurity is crucial, but it's not easy. This bill strikes that balance, codifying a framework for the relevant agencies to review and disclose vulnerabilities will improve cybersecurity and transparency to the benefit of the public while also ensuring that the federal government has the tools it needs to protect national security. Okay, except that, you know, if what they're suggesting is that Eternal Blue should have been made public 5 years ago, obviously there would be huge NSA pushback against that. So anyway, continuing, the bill does not go so far as to mandate the disclosure of all government zero-day exploits to relevant vendors for patching, but instead requires the Vulnerability Equities Review Board to develop a consistent and transparent process for decision making. It will create new oversight mechanisms to improve transparency and accountability while enhancing public trust in the process. It further requires that, quote, the head of each federal agency shall, upon obtaining information about a vulnerability that is not publicly known, subject such information to the process established. In this way, the Vulnerability Equities Review Board, it's hard to even say that.
That exists, only by the way, so this must be some sort of update to this.
Right. Has oversight over all zero-day vulnerabilities held by the government agencies. It also maintains the controls relating to whether, when, how, to whom, and to what degree information about a vulnerability that is not publicly known should be shared or released by the federal government to a non-federal entity. That is, whether the public interest requires the vendor be able to patch the vulnerability.
It's a balancing act, obviously, because if you're going to have spy agencies, they're going to collect these.
Well, and my take is this is total nonsense. A bunch of politicians who want to appear to be responding by creating more government bureaucracy, which is exactly, by the way, what our present administration was elected to reduce.
Right.
This will simply add regulation without effect. The CIA and NSA will loudly and probably honestly assert their need for these for national security. They will downplay the downside and explain how we are already losing the cyber war and how forcing voluntary disarmament would be unilaterally laying down our arms and capitulating in the cyber war. They'll argue that foreign governments who lack the Patch Act's attempted oversight controls will still be free to discover and use the very same software flaws against us. And that, as we have seen, even when patches were already made available, machines were still victimized. That is, you know, Microsoft patched this in March, and this happened, 2 weeks ago. And they'll also note correctly that Microsoft only back-patched XP and Vista because of the and as a result of the proven severity of the problem, which would argue that if they had informed Microsoft, oh, by the way, here's an SMB flaw, Microsoft certainly would have fixed the OSs that are widely in use and recent, but would never have bothered to fix XP and Vista. They did that only because it was such a problem. So that argues that even informing Microsoft of bad problems doesn't guarantee that all of the machines online will get fixed. So I would argue that this is just bureaucracy with no effect.
I think there has to be some discussion. I mean, unless you want to abolish anti-terrorist efforts, I don't think it's unreasonable for the government, for the NSA and the CIA to stockpile exploits, right? I mean, we're not saying that. And then it's also reasonable, and I think the NSA knows this full well. It was the Director of National Intelligence who set up the original vulnerability equities process in 2008. They understand the risk also of holding on to these. And so I think it's not inappropriate for some group of people who represent both the public interest and the interest of intelligence community somehow hash this out. Otherwise you just keep everything.
If it comes down to money, and as we know, so much often does, then if nothing else, maybe this if putting more money into protecting the secrets would have prevented that leak, then maybe that's the solution. That is, the fact that the NSA lost something that generated headlines that has been such a huge problem, if they needed more money in order to a budget in order to further and better secure their secrets, that's what they should ask for.
That's the solution, yeah.
Right.
It's just as hard to make perfect software as it is to make perfect spy. And I think this is real world. There's no obvious right answer, but I think it's appropriate to try to find an answer. I'm not sure how this differs from the existing vulnerability equities process, but,
a bunch of guys sitting around saying, oh, we found a really juicy one. We need to keep it. How is anyone going to say no? Right. You have to tell.
There was some evidence that Heartbleed was the NSA knew about Heartbleed for several years before it was discovered. It never leaked out. It was discovered.
Yep.
These are tools the NSA uses not for one of the things is this is generally, as far as I know, not used ever used for mass surveillance. It's used for targeted surveillance
because they don't want it to get out.
Right.
Yeah, so they're going to find someone somewhere and use it in order to perform a network penetration.
Right,
I think it's going the way it should. But I guess my point is the idea of this being a proper subject of a committee is ridiculous. This doesn't make sense for a bunch of bureaucrat heads of departments to sit around and say, the worse it is, the more powerful it is. And so the more useful it is. The mechanics just don't make sense. So, certainly if the NSA were to find something that they thought they should disclose, they would. They would say, hey, Brad, I meant to say Brad. I said Bill earlier. Brad Smith.
Brad Smith.
You know, here's a goodie for you. You probably just need to patch this soon, and they would. But that's, you know, it seems to me it's the discoverer needs to react responsibly, and no committee should reasonably expected to be able to impose their own judgment on.
Well, I'm not sure that's true, because there are. I mean, this is the existing VEP. And they have to answer questions like, how much is the vulnerable system used in the core internet infrastructure, in other infrastructure systems, in the U.S. economy? Does the vulnerability, if left unpatched, impose significant risk? How much harm could an adversary or criminal group do with knowledge? These are appropriate questions. And I think, who else is going to answer these questions? You got to sit down with people who, you know, both want to protect, you know, understand the issues and discuss it. How badly do we need the intelligence? Are there other ways we can get it? These are all questions that were supposedly going to be asked in the original process.
Those questions are great, right, and completely useless.
You're assuming bad will on the part of the spies who are going to say, no, you can't have anything. But
I'm not.
Oh,
I'm assuming self-interest. I'm assuming that they're representing, I mean, they understand how difficult it is to find a problem like this and how valuable it is to their needs. And I just don't think them explaining it to a panel of other, you know, agency heads is going to have any useful result. They're going to say, yeah, this is really bad, which makes it really important, really valuable. So it's like, I don't know, the concept of discussing it just to me, I mean, just seems.
Well, then you're giving up because they're just going to keep it. If there's no process at all, then there's no challenge to them just keeping it. Then you're just giving up and saying, well, they're going to have it.
Yeah. And I think the challenge is fake. I think it's a fake challenge. I think it's a made-up bureaucratic, you know, circle jerk.
Just to show that they care, even if they don't.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's a great cartoon on the next page of the show notes, Leo, that is the lead into this WannaCry kill switch. We discussed that it existed, and it didn't make sense to us. We now believe that we understand what it was for, and it was of dubious value. When it turns out that when malware is being forensically reverse engineered, it's put in a forensics sandbox. And malware often makes DNS queries out to its command and control servers. And so this forensic sandbox responds to the DNS queries with its own local server IP in order for the malware to attempt to connect to a command and control server. So a way of for malware to detect whether it is sandboxed and being forensically examined is to just ask for a gibberish DNS domain that doesn't exist. And if it cannot get a connection to a server at that DNS domain, it'll just assume it's not in a sandbox and do its dirty work. But if it does get a connection to a domain it knows it just made up, it was all gibberish characters. Remember, I insisted on reading most of that domain name last week. Then it goes, oh no, I must be in a sandbox. And so it alters its behavior.
In this case, smarter way to do this would not be to have a hard-coded domain, but just a random string each time, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
Which makes me wonder if this is really the rationale behind it. But maybe they really wanted a kill switch, like a real.
Yeah. This cartoon is wonderful because it shows some bad guys in masks with the skull and crossbones behind them saying, look, I included a few lines to check whether we've been sandboxed so white hats can't detect us. And so the other guy says, I'll just ping a non-existent domain. And then if the non-existent domain responds, it means we're in a sandbox. So we won't encrypt any files. That way, no one will notice us. And then the first guy says, ha ha, well done. We're going to get so many bitcoins. Then a few hours later, our now famous, unfortunately famous, he's not happy, by the way, how famous he is. We'll get to that in a second. He says, huh, what's this inactive domain hard-coded in their code? I should reserve it. You never know. And in the final frame, it says SH*T. When these guys realize, ooh, we've been foiled. And of course,
foiled, curses, you know, foiled again.
This thing completely neutered as a consequence of register. You're right, Leo. If they just used a random number, just used the little crypto API that they were already using to give them a chunk of entropy, convert that to 7-bit ASCII, stick a .com on the end of it and send it out, you know, then this very simple trigger wouldn't have happened. But, you know, that's the best theory for what they were trying to do.
And, unless they really wanted a kill switch. There might have been other reasons they wanted a kill switch.
Yeah.
Who knows?
So, meanwhile, what that creates is a server answering TCP connections at a known domain and thus a known IP. So what's the next logical thing to happen? Hackers now trying to reignite WannaCry with nonstop botnet attacks. In other words, the kill switch server is now being DDoSed continually by various Mirai and Mirai derivative botnets in order to force it offline, so that when the WannaCry worm reaches out to see if it should encrypt or not, it will, if it is unable to get a connection because the server, the kill switch server is being DDoSed, it'll go, oh, no one there, so off we go to encrypt the files on the drive. There are a few problems with this. First of all, only newly infected or rebooted systems propagate. So a new infection or a rebooted system, when the worm comes back alive from a reboot, they spend only the first 24 hours scanning for other vulnerable machines. Then they stop. So the point is, it's not as if putting the kill switch server under a persistent DDoS would immediately bring the WannaCry, the existing infection base of WannaCry, back to life. Instead, it would only, they'd have to keep it offline, and then only new infections or rebooted systems would then reach out to see whether the kill switch server is available and an attack. So, you know, it's like, yeah, okay, fine. And by the way, I mean, the company is working, the company behind the guy who found this, an LA-based security firm, is now gone to a unnamed DDoS protection service. And I didn't bother to check to see. It's easy. I mean, it's unnamed, but it's easy to figure out who it is because their servers are going to answer the IP for that domain. And so they're doing everything they can to help keep the TCP server at that domain responsive in order to keep the original variant of WannaCry from propagating. As we know, immediately that code was hex edited out and another version launched, and there have been, I think now the last count I heard was 5 variants of this. So, and then also, I didn't put it in the notes, but there's even another much different variant, which uses six different exploits from the NSA rather than just two, rather than just Eternal Blue and Double Pulsar. This uses a whole bunch of them. So, you know, the feeding frenzy has begun. And so the question is, who is Malware Tech? Who is this person? Unfortunately, he's in the UK, and the UK has rather notorious reporting. He apparently tried in vain to remain cyber and not identified in the physical world. Nowhere on either his Twitter page nor in his blog are there any names, details, headshots, anything that would connect him to the real world, which should make it clear that he wished to remain anonymous. But he was dogged by British tabloid reporters who dug deep into his entire online past and finally outed or doxed him as being a 22-year-old British security researcher named Marcus Hutchins. On the other hand, thanks to being known, the ethical hacker group HackerOne has awarded him $10,000 for his efforts, and Marcus stated that he intends to split that award between charity and educational resources for students who cannot afford them. In the show notes here, I have a snapshot of several of his posts. He tweets as Malware Tech Blog, and so he tweeted, "I knew 5 minutes of fame would be horrible, but honestly, I misjudged just how horrible. British tabloids are super invasive." He tweeted, "Journalist doxed a friend, then rang them offering money for my girlfriend's name and phone number. One turned up at another friend's house." He tweeted, "Tabloids here don't care about the story. They care about every detail of the person behind it and will go to extreme lengths to find out." And then finally, he said, "One of the largest UK newspapers published a picture of my house, full address, and directions to get there. Now I have to move." So it's the world we live in today, unfortunately. Okay, on the question of decrypting WannaCry, there's been a lot of confusion and misinformation, a real sort of a development frenzy to see whether there was a way to decrypt. And now there's some sanity that has come to this and things have settled down. We sort of know what's going on. There is a function in the Windows cryptographic API called Crypt Release Context. So the idea is that when you're going to start doing a bunch of cryptographic work, you acquire a cryptographic context from Windows, and so Windows gives you a handle, and then you apply different actions, different methods, different functions against that handle. So the handle is an abstraction of a cryptographic context. The idea being that Windows is supposed to handle all of the messy business for you. So you say things like create asymmetric key, and it just does. And then you say use that key to do this or do that and so forth. And so Windows provides this interface and deals with it all. Well, when you're done, you want to explicitly destroy any sensitive information that may have transiently existed. So you release the context. You say to Windows, here's that handle, that context handle you gave me. I'm releasing it back to the system. You hope that Windows proactively wipes and zeros all of the memory that was involved in any sensitive operations. It turns out, believe it or not, that I'm not sure about Windows 8, but at least we know Windows 10 does, but Windows 7 does not. So XP, Vista and 7, the API up through 7 at least, does not proactively wipe the memory. As a consequence, sensitive memory contents containing both the symmetric key and even the two primes, which were originally obtained in order to compose the private key, the RSA private key, have been found after the fact in memory from XP through Windows 7. So if a XP, Vista, or Win 7 machine is encrypted with WannaCry, and if it's not powered down, it's very likely that the key can be found, and there is now the best software. I've got links to the various GitHub projects. There is one called WannaKiwi, WannaKiwi. That looks like it's the best and easiest to use. You can simply run it, WannaKiwi.exe. You just run it. It will find the process, scan the process memory, find the private key, find the primes, reconstruct the RSA key from them, and then use that in order to return all of your files, to decrypt all of your files. Obviously, it's with lots of limitations. You can't have used the machine a lot, or that increases the probability of something overwriting that memory, which was released back to the operating system. It should have wiped it. Windows 10 does. But apparently, we don't know about 8.1, but Windows 7 is known not to. And in their testing of it, under XP, every attempt to decrypt when the machine had not been powered down, and I'm not sure about rebooting, whether that would wipe the memory. It doesn't necessarily wipe the memory when you reboot. But that probably makes it much more difficult to find. Within these limitations, it looks like it's possible, but that's as a consequence of these developers using the crypto API.
It's so funny. It's another Windows bug that's being used to mitigate.
Yep.
Father Robert's going to do it on know-how. He's already infected a machine. We have a little mini network he did
week.
Last week he WannaCry'd it. This week he's going to WannaCry it and see if the defection disinfection works.
Cool. Nice.
Yeah.
And for example, this is one of the reasons I'm not using any unknown functional crypto API in the Squirrel code.
NACL, it's all, baby.
It's all my own. Yeah.
You're not even using NACL?
I use Bernstein's crypto stuff, but I maintain my own security region, swap locked, so it can't be swapped out. And my code is constantly zeroing that region. The moment it's through with anything sensitive, it proactively wipes it. And I've got various monitor daemons that are always checking to make sure that nothing happened that allowed anything to stay there. So I've been, that's the way you write secure code, is you from the first moment you are scrupulous about the way you manage the secrets in your code.
Right. Not Microsoft, apparently.
No. And our friend Simon Zarafa tweeted, 98% of WannaCry victims running Windows 7. Can we finally nail the lid shut on the XP myth? And in the show notes here is a picture that Kaspersky created and the Bleeping Computer quoted, showing the various infection levels. What we know is that XP can be infected, but the worm doesn't propagate. The worm's SMB attack fails on XP. but it does succeed on Windows 7. So the reason so many Windows 7 machines are infected is that there is actually a mistake in the packet composition for the exploit that didn't infect XP. So yes, we have closure on that too. And time for a coffee break.
Okay. Yes, sir. Yes, boss. Our show today brought to you by the very fine, very wonderful, very happy Ring Video Doorbell. I have Ring on my front door, and I know, in fact, you know probably, because every once in a while I forget to mute my phone, and you hear those chimes that say somebody's walking up my step. Ring has a camera in it, a speaker, a microphone, and motion detection. So it's not just when somebody rings my bell, though that's a different sound when somebody rings my bell and I'll know they're ringing my bell. I can speak to them. I can see them no matter where I am anywhere in the world because I pair the Ring Video Door. It's on my Wi-Fi, and I use the Ring app on my phone, and so I'm always able to see what's going on at my door. Now Ring has a new device. You've seen the stick-up cams. These are basically Ring doorbells minus the doorbell, just the camera, the microphone, and the speaker. Now they have the floodlight cam. This is a motion-activated camera and floodlight that connects to your phone. HD video, two-way audio, as always. So anytime somebody steps on your property, if it's at night, boom, the floodlight comes on. You see them, and you can say, hey, get off of my property. It could even set off an alarm. Or you can, actually, right from your phone. Or just call the police. With the floodlight cam, when things go bump in the night, you'll know what it is that's bumping, whether you're at home or away. This is the ultimate in home security. High visibility floodlights, a powerful HD camera. Security is in your hands. Ring is so huge. I mean, they've been so successful. In fact, now this floodlight cam was named the Wall Street Journal's Best of CES 2017. Monitor every corner of your property with a Ring security kit. Check out those Ring of Security kits at ring.com/security now. All kits include the Ring Video Doorbell and your choice of either 1, 2, or 3 floodlight cams. You connect your doorbell with your favorite smart locks, with your hubs for added convenience and monitoring and security. And with Ring, I love it because I'm always home and I always know who's at my door. I don't miss a package. And when they leave the package, I can keep an eye on the package. When somebody comes to my house that isn't anybody I know, I can chase them off. Save up to $150 off a Ring of Security kit right now when you go to ring.com/security now, ring.com/security now. You'll really appreciate, too, the thoughtfulness. This is a great company. This is the Ring doorbell. Comes with a screwdriver, a drill bit, a level, the charging cord, because this is the original Ring, has a battery in it in case you don't have wiring. Special screwdriver bit for security, that special pentalobe on the bottom there. I love it. They make it very easy. And I'm no handyman, but I installed my Ring in just under an hour because I wanted to watch all the videos first. Ring.com/security now. I'm saying Ring's all over the neighborhood these days, which kind of is nice because that means everybody's protecting everybody else. All right, Steve, we continue on with our
security. So how many infections? The latest count from the WannaCry sinkhole, the kill switch server, is 416,989.
Wow.
Individual IPs. Now, apparently, that's not including the 604,102 unique IPs from manual visits to the domain. So, non-worm. Visits, just people curious.
I've done that.
I guess.
I typed it in.
Check that crazy.
See what's going on there.
Yeah. So just shy of 417,000 infected machines.
Wow.
That's a biggie.
Yeah.
The Wall Street Journal is, of course, has their content behind a paywall. And there was a blurb in Apple News that I saw yesterday, but I didn't read it there at the moment. And now I can't get to it, and I'm unwilling to give – you know, I just don't use the Wall Street Journal enough for it to make sense for me to pay for what's there. But I just – I did the title of the article was All IT Jobs Are Cybersecurity Jobs Now. And the subhead was The Rise of Cyber Threats Means That the People Once Assigned to Setting Up Computers and Email Servers – Now treat security as top priority. And I just, even though that's all of the story that I had, that's really as much as we need for this podcast.
Yeah.
And I just thought that was an interesting sign of the times. And of course, I think really good news that rather than, you know, there being like some guy who's, you know, job is security. We've talked about this, that it's not something that one person can be responsible for in a huge organization. All of IT, everybody has to have at least that in the back of their mind, at least an awareness of the security consequences and implications of everything they do. And sure, you could still have a czar who keeps reminding them and refreshing them. I read someone sent me a note in, over the course of the last week, that their company actually sets up fake external pseudo entities from and that sends mail into their company trying to trap their own employees into clicking on a link. And then if it works, they get a visit from someone in the corporation saying, yesterday you got this email and you clicked on it and we need to have a talk because you could bring down the entire organization.
Yeah. Isn't that great?
So that's yay.
Funny. Yeah.
Okay. So Stack Overflow, I, you know, as a developer, when I'm in a hurry and I just want a quick answer to something, I Google a phrase, and more often than not, Stack Overflow is the first five responses. And, you know, the content is not super high quality. There's a lot of people giving their opinions, but it's a starting point. And very often there will be a link to something that will be definitive, and it's like, oh, great. So it's a, for me, I mean, I'm intimately familiar with Stack Overflow. They have a huge, and you know, Stack Exchange is the family, and it's a huge and sprawling website. So yesterday, that as I wrote here in the show notes, the well-known, very popular, and sprawling Stack Exchange family of developer-oriented websites completed their conversion to HTTPS. Nick Craver, who's a software developer and systems admin for Stack Exchange, who spearheaded this work, yesterday detailed the journey in a very lengthy blog post. I have the link here in the show notes. And I read through a lot of it. Nick is sick and tired of everyone saying, just use Let's Encrypt, as if that would simply solve a problem. So his detailed posting explains and will be of interest to anyone who wants to gain a better understanding of why just use Let's Encrypt is not the answer for, you know, for every case. To get some sense for the nature of the challenge, Nick had a bulleted summary noting that, quote, for example, we have hundreds of domains, many sites and other services, many second-level domains, stackoverflow.com, stackexchange.com, askubuntu.com, and so on. Many fourth-level domains, for example, meta.gaming.stackexchange.com. He says, we allow user-submitted and embedded content, images, and YouTube videos and posts. We serve from a single data center. We have ads and ad networks. We use web sockets, north of 500,000 active back to our server at any given time. We get DDoSed, so we have to have proxies. We have many sites and apps communicating via HTTP APIs, and he says in parens, proxy is creating proxy issues, and we're obsessed with performance, and he says in parens, maybe a little too much. So anyway, to summarize, he says the most common question we get, why not use Let's Encrypt? And he says, answer, because they don't work for us. that is, Let's Encrypt won't work for us. Let's Encrypt, he says, is doing a great thing. I hope they keep at it. If you're on a single domain or only a few domains, they're a pretty good option for a wide variety of scenarios. We are simply not in that position. Stack Exchange, he writes, has hundreds of domains. Let's Encrypt doesn't offer wildcards. These two things are at odds with each other. We'd have to get a certificate or two every time we deployed a new Q&A site or any other service. That greatly complicates deployment and either A, drops non-SNI clients. Remember, that's server name identification, where it allows multiple domains to reside at a single IP. And he notes that even today, around 2% of their traffic are non-SNI aware clients. So they're, you know, 1 in 50. Or B, requires far more IP space than we have, meaning that they would need, in order to accommodate that, they'd need to bind individual certificates to IPs, and they don't have that many IPs. And he says, another reason we want to control the certificate is we need to install the exact same certificates on both our local load balancers, which terminate the, and I'm adding this, which terminate the TLS connections and then forward the traffic to the servers behind them, and our CDN proxy provider. Unless we can do that, we can't fail over, that is, away from a proxy, cleanly in all cases. Anyone that has the certificate pinned via HPKP, which is HTTP public key pinning, would then fail validation. We're evaluating whether we'll deploy HPKP, but we've prepped as if we will later. And then he finally says, I've gotten a lot of raised eyebrows at our main certificate having all our primary domains plus wildcards. Here's what that looks like. And I have a picture of it in the show notes, and I had to smile when I saw who Stack Exchange chose to do and to build for them an amazing certificate. And our listeners can probably guess. It's DigiCert. And they produced an amazing certificate because it is a high assurance extended validation. The EV is an EV root, but it is also an SHA-2 high assurance. I'm trying to decide if the Stack Exchange certificate is EV. Can you go to www.stackexchange.com, Leo?
Sure.
And see if you get an EV flag, because I'm assuming since it's signed by they have a high assurance intermediate and the EV root.
Yes, it's green. That means
okay.
It's,
so you can't normally get that. I mean, EV certs. They had to go to some serious hoop jumping in order to create a certificate like this.
You can't do wildcard. There's all sorts of. I mean, this is not.
Yes, this is not.
Never promised to be the ultimate solution that would put everybody else out of business.
Correct. And then in Nick's Q&A, he asks himself the question, "Where do you get certificates?" And then he answered, "We use DigiCert. They've been awesome."
Yeah, so do we. That's what twit.tv is.
And everyone knows I do too. Yes. So they got DigiCert to make them a very special extended validation certificate with a massive SAN, which we were also talking recently, because remember that there's going to be a deprecation of the use of the certificate's name in favor of only domains explicitly listed in the subject alternative name, the SAN record, which in this case enumerates all of their various domains and wildcards for subdomains underneath those domains. And he says, and of course, issuing that would have taken a great deal of careful work on DigiCert's part, because they needed to firmly and with EV, veracity, verify and prove ownership of every root in that second level domain set. So, you know, bravo to Stack Exchange for, you know, making the effort, a significant effort, to go to HTTPS and DigiCert for providing them with the ability to do that, essentially. And yes, as you say, Leo, you know, as he explained, it's, you know, Let's Encrypt is not the simple answer except for simple certificates. So it achieves what they were trying to achieve, which is, you know, lowering the bar and making it difficult for someone to say, oh, you know, we're not HTTPS because, you know, it doesn't make sense for us to afford a certificate. Well, now, you know, simple DV, simple server certs can be free. Okay, so ProPublica and Gizmodo co-published this report on hacking Mar-a-Lago. I've got the links in the show notes, but I'll just share the top of it, which is kind of fun and summarizes it. They wrote, 2 weeks ago, on a sparkling spring morning, we went trawling, in more ways than one, along Florida's coastal waterway, but not for fish. We parked a 17-foot motorboat in a lagoon about 800 feet from the back lawn of the Mar-a-Lago Club in Palm Beach, and pointed a 2-foot wireless antenna that resembled a potato gun toward the club. Within a minute, we spotted 3 weakly encrypted Wi-Fi networks, and I assume that means
WEP, right?
Yeah. WEP encryption. We could have hacked them in less than 5 minutes. But we refrained. Of course, they're publishing this publicly, so you bet they are saying they refrained. A few days later, we drove through the grounds of the Trump National Golf Club in Bedminster, New Jersey, with the same antenna and aimed it at the clubhouse. We identified 2 open Wi-Fi networks that anyone could join without a password. We resisted the temptation. We have also visited 2 President Donald Trump's other family-run retreats, the Trump International Hotel in Washington, D.C., and a golf club in Sterling, Virginia. Our inspections found weak and open Wi-Fi networks, wireless printers without passwords, we know how juicy those are, servers with outdated and vulnerable software, and unencrypted login pages to back-end databases containing sensitive information. The risks, they write, posed by the lax security, experts say, go well beyond simple digital snooping. Sophisticated hackers could take advantage of vulnerabilities in the Wi-Fi networks to take over devices like computers or smartphones and use them to record conversations involving anyone on the premises. Quote, these networks all have to be crawling with foreign intruders, not just ProPublica, said Dave Attell, chief executive officer of Immunity Inc., a digital security company, when we told him what we found. And of course, that's the first thing I thought and our listeners would think is, you know, yes, ProPublica is not going to do anything that would create a felony cyber intrusion offense for them. But
I'm surprised the Secret Service didn't come on over and say, hey, what you doing with that potato gun? I mean, seriously. Yes.
I know. I was watching something. I don't remember now who it was. I it was some show where somebody resides next to Mar-a-Lago and with a reporter and a camera crew walked out onto the beach and walked over to Mar-a-Lago and walked right
I'm
up
sure
onto
the president
the,
wasn't there at the
ground.
Time, though, right?
Yeah.
Don't you think there's a little better security when he's there? Not that
well,
that's...
We would like to hope that. The problem is we already know the printers are easily taken over and used as a beachhead. And apparently there are open printers with no passwords. It's like, oh, Lord. So, yeah. Security lapses, they write, are not uncommon in the hospitality industry, which, like most industries and government agencies, is under increasing attack from hackers. But they are more worrisome in places where the President of the United States, heads of state, and public officials regularly visit. U.S. leaders, they write, can ill afford such vulnerabilities. As both the U.S. and French presidential campaign showed, hackers increasingly exploit weaknesses in internet security systems in an effort to influence elections and policies. Since the election, Trump has hosted Chinese President Xi Jinping, Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, and British politician Nigel Farage at his properties. The cybersecurity issues we discovered could have allowed those diplomatic discussions and other sensitive conversations at the properties to be monitored by hackers. And of course, the last thing we want in this case is for anyone to be blackmailed as a consequence of information that would be disclosed that way. Yikes. And speaking of yikes, Theresa May is said to be creating a new internet to be controlled and regulated by the government. What we understand now, though, reading into this a bit, is that she is proposing to simply hyper-regulate the, you know, what internet connectivity they have control over. This was reported by the Independent Co.UK saying that Theresa May is planning to introduce huge regulations on the way the internet works, allowing the government to decide what is said online. And Leo, prepare yourself, because I know how you're going to feel about this. The plans will allow Britain to become, quote, the global leader in the regulation of the use of personal data and the internet, the manifesto claims. The manifesto suggests the government might stop search engines like Google from directing people to pornographic websites. Quote, we will put a responsibility on industry not to direct users, even unintentionally, to hate speech, pornography, or other sources of harm, unquote, the conservatives write. Particular focus has been drawn to the end of the manifesto, which makes clear that the Tories want to introduce huge changes to the way the internet works. Quote, some people say that it is not for government to regulate when it comes to technology and the internet, it states. We disagree. Quote, in harnessing the global, harnessing the digital revolution, we must take steps to protect the vulnerable and give people confidence to use the internet without fear of abuse, criminality, or exposure to horrific content, unquote. The manifesto claims in a section called, quote, the safest place to be online. They write, our starting point is that online rules should reflect those that govern our lives offline. Explaining the justification for a new level of regulation, it should be as unacceptable to bully online as it is in the playground, as difficult to groom a young child on the internet as it is in a community, as hard for children to access violent and degrading pornography online as it is in the street, and as difficult to commit a crime digitally as it is physically. Yeah, good luck with all of that. That's me saying that. The manifesto also proposes that internet companies will have to pay a levy, like the one currently paid by gambling firms. Just like with gambling, that money will be used to pay for advertising schemes to tell people about the dangers of the internet, in particular, being used to support awareness and preventive activity to counter internet harms, according to the manifesto. The conservatives will also seek to regulate the kind of news. Wow. Fasten your seatbelt, Jeff Jarvis, that is posted online, and how companies are paid for it. If elected, Theresa May will, quote, take steps to protect the reliability and objectivity of information that is essential to our democracy, and crack down on Facebook and Google to assure that news companies get enough advertising money. What?
What?
If internet companies refuse to comply with the rulings, a suggestion that some have already made about the powers in the Investigatory Powers Act, then there will be a strict and strong set of ways to punish them. Jeez. Quote, we will introduce a sanctions regime to ensure compliance, giving regulators the ability to fine or prosecute those companies that I know that fail in their legal duties, and to order the removal of content where it clearly breaches UK law, the manifesto states. In laying out its plan for increased regulation, the Tories anticipate and reject potential criticism that such roles could put people at risk. Quote, while we cannot create this framework alone, it is for government, not private companies, to protect the security of people and ensure the fairness of the rules by which people and businesses abide. The document reads, quote, nor do we agree that the risks of such an approach outweigh the potential benefits.
Wow.
I know. It's breathtaking.
Yeah.
I mean, it is goodbye the internet that we have known. And another example of, you know, personal responsibility being apparently just something that we shouldn't be responsible for.
Right.
Yeah. Wow.
What you gonna do?
So, an update on the state of certificate revocation. To sort of remind everyone where we've come from, the problem is that certificates are issued for a fixed time period. They have an expiration date, typically no longer than 3 years, in some cases two, in some cases one, and in some cases even shorter. In the case, for example, of Let's Encrypt, where you have an automated issuance system. So it makes sense to shorten the expiration time because you've reduced the burden to near nothing to reissue. And so that's one way of mitigating the problem with revocation. The revocation problem is that if a certificate is newly issued for, say, for 3 years, and then something happens that it gets out of control, the certificate's private key, which is, you know, essentially the certificate signed by an authority, escapes the control of its owner, then that would allow someone to maliciously use that in concert with a domain intercept or a traffic rerouting to take somebody to a site that is able to appear as a legitimate, to legitimately appear as the domain that certificate covers. Or horrifyingly, in the case of Stack Exchange, all the domains, the hundreds of domains that certificate covers. So it was always recognized that there needed to be a means of managing revocation. That is some way. Once a certificate, because it's like, you know, the certificate is a static, self-contained assertion of its own validity. The statement it's making is, anyone who presents this certificate is the valid owner of the domain that is bound, the domain name bound in that certificate. So that's, and it has an expiration date. It has a not valid before, not valid after pair of time, date and time stamps. But so it can exist independently and is assumed to be valid until the expiration date, unless something intercedes, thus revocation. It can be revoked by the CA, the certificate authority, but how is the knowledge of that revocation conveyed to somebody who wants to trust the assertion that the certificate makes? Originally, we had what's known as a CRL, a certificate revocation list. Every certificate authority would publish a list and would maintain the list periodically. The problem is, as the internet exploded and as more sites wanted HTTPS and initially SSL and then TLS secure connections, that we had an explosion of certificates. With that came an explosion in the size of the revocation lists. And the model of revocation lists was always kind of broken, because it would mean that a user's browser that connected to a domain would get a certificate from the domain's server, would then look in the certificate for the URL of the signing authority's CRL server, and would ask that certificate revocation list server for the list of all revoked certificates. And this list could be huge. Technically, once the certificate has naturally expired after its three-year life, plus some slop for clock error, then that certificate could be removed from the list because the certificate has expired itself by virtue of its own the time and date stamp that it carries. But still, that means that all certificates that have not yet expired plus some fudge factor would have to be on the list. And the model's broken because the browser just wants to check one domain. Instead, the model is ask a CA for every revoked certificate that isn't yet expired in a single list. And then the browser goes and searches it to see, to see if the one it cares about is in the list. So that was all bad. Chrome came along from Google, and of course they basically did nothing. Google went their own way and created what I actually revealed to be a wholly non-functional solution known as CRL sets, which when I looked at them, I realized, well, this can't work. And so, because it's basically a small list of highly publicized, high-profile revoked certificates. There were like seven of them when I first looked, plus a bunch of EV certificates that had been revoked. But back then, most certificates weren't. Well, even today, most certificates are not EV. Most of them are just DV, domain validation, not extended validation. And so I created a revoked.grc.com cert, and it generated a lot of news. So Google added it. It was like certificate number seven in their revoked list. And so I thought, okay, fine. And I created another one. And they haven't bothered to revoke that one, because then I would just create a third. The point is, Chrome doesn't do this either. Completely broken. On the other hand, if you go to revoked.grc.com in Firefox, you get an error page. It says security error revoked certificate. So, gee, Firefox is doing it. Chrome isn't. Okay, so what was created then was an online facility. Instead of getting the whole list, the idea was in the what's called the OCSP model, the Online Certificate Status Protocol, the browser would fetch a certificate from a site it wants to have a secure connection to, receives the cert. In the cert is an OCSP URL, which is which gives it the domain of the server that serves the OCSP protocol. So now the browser simply asks for a specific domain. Is this domain valid? And the OCSP server says yes or no, depending. So that's like way better, but it's got some problems. If the OCSP server doesn't respond, then does it fail not trusting or fail trusting? Because if it fails not trusting, an outage of the OCSP protocol server would prevent you from accessing that site. On the other hand, if it fails trusting, then bad guys could DDoS the server to get their certificate trusted, or could block the OCSP traffic in order to get it to be trusted. So you're sort of messed up either way. Also, it creates a substantial additional round trip time. You've got to establish a TCP connection, bring up TLS because you need this to be a secure exchange, and then the communication. So it creates an additional time overhead and slows everything down. And this is for every HTTPS connection that the browser would make to additional domains for the page. So it's better, but it's still got lots of problems. The next idea was, let's have the server which is serving the certificate staple, as the term is, a recently received OCSP assertion to the TLS transaction. So the idea being that the certificate lives a long time, but the OCSP assertion doesn't. And so periodically the server, the web server that wants to serve, you know, high integrity certificates, it will go and get the OCSP assertion and include that in the handshake. That eliminates the overhead of the browser having to do it. It allows a long-lived certificate and short-lived, you know, reassertions that there's been no expiration so far, and so to keep it valid. And so that's sort of nice, except there's still a problem, because the OCSP can't be in the signed certificate, because that's digitally signed and you can't change the certificate. So the OCSP staple has to be in the protocol separate from the certificate. But that means if bad guys steal the certificate, they just won't provide a stapled OCSP, and so we're back to the beginning again. So the final solution was to embed in the certificate itself, the original signed certificate, a new flag, OCSP must staple. So now the certificate says the server serving this must provide a valid OCSP staple, or this certificate is invalid. So that solves the problem of bad guys getting a certificate and just not including a staple, and also getting in the way of the OCSP and the need for the browser to go out and fetch its own OCSP information, thus slowing down all the transactions. So all of that seems great, except where we are today is that neither of the two majority web servers on the internet, which would be Apache with about a 46% share and Nginx with about a 20% share, neither of them have it correctly implemented. They are both badly broken. The idea should be that the server caches the most recent OCSP staple information and includes it with all the certificates that it hands out, like, you know, in the TLS handshake. And then periodically, as it, you know, like as it begins to approach expiration, it reaches out to the OCSP server to refresh its cached OCSP assertion. It turns out that both Apache and Nginx are horribly broken. If anything happens that causes an invalid OCSP to be received or no OCSP to be received, rather than saying, oh, shoot, it's a good thing I started asking early, I'll wait a bit and try again, like and again and again and again and again, hopefully finally achieving success before the existing staple expires. Instead, Nginx and Apache, if anything happens to their attempt to obtain a refresh, they invalidate the still valid OCSP staple in their cache, thereby failing all connections to any server whose certificate has OCSP must staple in the certificate in order to succeed. So, okay, that means nobody can even today actually use OCSP must staple until the majority web servers on the internet get themselves fixed. And people have tried to turn it on and immediately started having problems. So right now, and by the way, this problem was reported in 2014 to the Apache group, and it remains unfixed today. So it apparently they've got other things to do, or it just isn't high enough on their priority list, or they don't care. I don't know. But it's always been a problem for – I mean, the problem of revocation has always been known, and we've never yet come up with a good fix. We're getting closer, but as – you know, one of the enduring lessons of this podcast is these things which are broken or are trying to evolve – just happen on a very slow time scale. And Leo, it's coffee time.
How much coffee can one man drink? Our show today, okay, take a break. Time for coffee. Smoke them if you got them. While I talk a little bit about, I think, one of the best sponsors ever. Let me click the right link. I like all our sponsors, but I love Cloudflare because Cloudflare is making the internet a safer place, not just for its customers, but for you and me as well. Cloudflare is on a mission to help build a better internet. They make your site or app. Don't forget, they can work with apps too. Faster, safer, more reliable. Means you don't have to worry about slow loading page times, downtime, or getting hacked. Incredibly easy to use. Sign up takes less than 5 minutes. And by the way, there's a free tier, free, like free forever. If you want to use Cloudflare for your website, and I'll tell you why. They want to get as many people as they can using Cloudflare because it helps them support their firewall, you know, their wide area firewall, web application firewall. If you report a problem, a malware attack, anything that's going wrong on the internet, they can add those rules to the web application firewall and protect everybody. It's kind of a crowdsourced firewall, massively IP reputation-based. It updates for everybody. Of course, they have their own 24/7 team watching the internet
for new vulnerabilities, deploying real-time protection. You've, I know, heard about Cloudflare in a few different contexts. They're a CDN, a content distribution network, with 115-plus data centers all over the world that moves your content, that cache your content, moves it closer to your customer, so it loads faster. That's one thing. But they also do, they're famous for their DDoS protection. In fact, when Steve was getting DDoS, they immediately called him up and said, whatever you need, Steve Free, we'll be glad to help you. He didn't use it because he didn't really care, but very famously, it's like, yeah, big deal if GRC's down. But if you care if your site's down, this is a great solution. And they help you avoid cloud provider lock-in, whether you're using Azure or AWS or Google Cloud or whatever. Cloudflare works with all of them, gives your business the option to use more than one so you're never locked in. I can go on and on, but here's what we want to give you. First of all, take a look at the plans. Go to cloudflare.com/twit. Free. If your personal website is not running behind Cloudflare already, you should just go do that right now. $20 a month, $200 a month, giant websites. They've got custom plans for you, too. And you can find out everything about Cloudflare. I can't tell you in my limited time everything Cloudflare does. It's kind of amazing. But you know, I have John Graham coming. Their CTO is an old friend. He's been on this show. Great guy. He was on this show because he got the British government to apologize posthumously to Alan Turing, which was a pretty amazing feat. But he's also a great technologist. Everybody at Cloudflare is great. In fact, one of the things you could do if you go right now to cloudflare.com/twit is sign up for a kind of a question and answer session with Cloudflare, one of Cloudflare's just absolute best support guys. Jameson Sundell is amazing. He can answer any question you've got. You can find out more about Cloudflare. And that's free only for Twit listeners. So if you want to register for a session, visit cloudflare.com/twit. No, GRC's not down now. This was a while ago. People are going, it's up for me. And yes, Alan Turing is dead, but this is what it posthumously means, after his death. Anyway, I'm sorry. cloudflare.com/twit. These guys are really great, and they're here to help you. More than 6 million websites and apps and APIs and SaaS companies use Cloudflare. Why not you? cloudflare.com/twit. All right, Steve has been caffeinated, I presume.
Well, yeah, and for me, the problem was many of the fun things that GRC does cannot function behind a proxy.
Yeah,
they cannot function behind a proxy.
Right.
You know, I need to send probes out and, you know, DNS queries and all kinds of, you know, special stuff. So GRC is not just your generic website. So it's a much bigger challenge. And in fact, I would argue it's not possible to DDoS protect GRC. So, you know, had that continued, I would have, you know, and I was seriously for a while considering suspending those services that cannot be hidden.
You know, temporarily. Yeah.
Well, no, I would have just killed it. It's like, you know, I'm not getting any money for these things. I'm just doing it as a service.
Well, whoever that was has gone away, so knock on wood.
So, Firefox is considering giving up on OCSB for DV certs. So this is the last shoe to drop on the OCSB side. They filed a bug report. Just because that's how they sort of communicate, saying that their telemetry indicates that fetching OCSP results is an important cause of slowness in the first TLS handshake. Firefox, they write, is today the only major browser still fetching OCSP by default for DV certificates. You know, meaning the lowliest common form, not even OV, which is organizational validation, but just domain validation. It's like, yes, you've proven to me that you have this domain. They said earlier we tried reducing the OCSP timeout to 1 second, and meaning that they were going to wait less long for an answer, which would, if an OCSB result was slow to come, they wouldn't hang the whole connection. They said, but that seems to have caused only a 2% improvement in SSL time until handshake finished metric. So this bug, as they call it, it's not really a bug, it's a feature, is to disable OCSB fetching for DV certs. OCSB fetching should remain enabled, they write, for EV certificates. And OCSB stapling will remain fully functional. We encourage everyone to use OCSB stapling. So essentially, they're just saying, you know, we're being hurt because we're being hurt in comparative performance because we're the last browser to bother actually checking to see whether a DV certificate may have been revoked. And so we're going to stop doing that, which is sad. And they are explaining that stapling, they will still honor if a server staples. And of course, as we just covered, that doesn't provide you with the firm guarantee, but we're getting there. But what we need now is the server technologies to properly implement the OCSB stapling so that certificates can then safely add the OCSB must staple, and then we'll finally have a sane and workable solution for revocation. But it's difficult to get there. Bleepy Computer covered some interesting research. Where is C? I didn't follow the report down. I've got the PDF, ethz.ch. I know them, but it's not coming to mind who they are. But a bunch of researchers had discovered that the latest generation, which are the MLC, the multi-level cell SSDs, can be subject to physical adjacency disturbances similar to what we've seen with DRAM and the Rowhammer attacks. And our listeners will remember that I deliberately purchased SLC, single level cell SSDs for GRC, just because I was suspicious of MLC. It seemed like a kind of a cheesy thing to do in order to squeeze more bits into the same space. Yes, you get more density, but you're going to lower your integrity. And I don't need that much server space anyway. Anyway, there are two attacks they've come up with. One called program interference, the program interference attack, as they named it, occurring when data is deliberately written in specific ways and in MLC SSDs results in a 4.9 factor increase in the SSD's error rate. This, they write, can corrupt the SSD's stored data and shorten the device's lifetime. So this is bad. This is like a statically applicable attack to deliberately damage an SSD. The second attack, they call read disturb, occurs when a large number of specially patterned reads, which is very Rowhammer reminiscent, are performed within a short time. The researchers said these read disturb errors will, quote, corrupt both pages already written to partially programmed word lines in memory and pages that have yet to be written, thus ruining the SSD's ability to store data in a reliable manner in the future. Now, I would counter this, and I did not have time to look at their paper in depth, but it is uncommon that software probably has the kind of access that would be needed. It's not clear to me whether sector level read and write access is granular enough to induce these kinds of problems. But I wanted to put it on our radar that it looks like it's not just DRAMs that are vulnerable as a consequence of this rush to density. Remember that it's the newer DRAM, the DDR3s and 4s, that as a consequence of the crazy density that they now have, that minimize the cell sizes in DRAM that subjected them to this noise induction from adjacent row interference. Similarly, it's the crazy rush to density which caused manufacturers for competitive pressure reasons to need to put multiple bits of data into the same cell by creating multi-levels of charge, and then they needed to discriminate among those levels of charge in order to re-extract the bits. And so there are now 2 bits and even 3 bits per cell, and that just reduces the error margin, and then of course makes them vulnerable to, now we know, this kind of attack. And this kind of attack looks like a persistent attack. That is a static problem, whereas Rowhammer is just a dynamic problem. It came to my attention that Twitter has just discontinued their support of the Do Not Track browser preference. They wrote, "While we had hoped that our support for Do Not Track would spur industry adoption, an industry standard approach to Do Not Track did not materialize. We now offer more granular privacy controls, and you can learn more about them outlined in the articles below." And while I looked, and they're completely, it's like it's nothing. And so what I think this really means, reading between the lines, is that Twitter has chosen to no longer respect the user's browser sending of the DNT, the Do Not Track query header. They've chosen to ignore it. And it's difficult to see how, if they were truly concerned about respecting privacy, they would choose to disable a privacy-enhancing feature that they had already implemented. I mean, they had already done the work. So why decide, we changed our mind, we're going to take it out? So what must actually be happening is that they want to be able to track users whose browsers are sending out the Do Not Track beacon, and this statement is their way of justifying that. They're essentially saying other services are ignoring their visitors' explicit requests to not be tracked, so now we're going to ignore it also. Like, okay. Yeah. Unfortunate. I got a bunch of tweets, not surprisingly, from people telling me, informing me that the LastPass authenticator would now be able to back up our two-factor data online. Robert tweeted, LastPass, at SGGRC, at LastPass Authenticator can now back up your two-factor data online. Samuel Movey said, at SGGRC, I guess you won't be using your QR printouts much. In the future, LastPass will store two-factor codes alongside your passwords. And Sean Stevens tweeted at SGGRC, someone at LastPass is listening to Security Now. LastPass Authenticator now backs up the LastPass account for recovery and sync. My response, this is not a good thing. This is bad. Multi-factor security requires heterogeneous deployment.
Yes.
The idea is that my password and my time-based tokens must both be provided to log on. But if the same service contains both my password and my master set of time-based token keys, a single compromise of that service renders my entire use of a second factor meaningless. Also, I don't want an authenticator that is willing to export my time-based token keys. Anyone who gains control of a device's UI could export the key set. So the optimal solution is what I am doing and what I have recommended. Choose an authenticator app, not LastPass's app, that, and I don't like LastPass's app either because it's so, the things are so huge, you've got to scroll through in order to see a six-digit number. I'd much rather have a, I'm using Google's authenticator, although there's another one that I haven't gotten around to looking at that apparently has an even denser display, which I would prefer. So choose an authenticator app that deliberately does not allow for time-based token key export, like Google's authenticator does not, and you take, or I take, responsibility for managing the time-based token keys yourself. Yes, it's more work, but it's also the only way to actually obtain the security offered by a second factor. That's not something you want to relegate, and certainly not to the person who's storing all of your first factors.
So I never used the LastPass authenticator.
I will be printing out my QR codes. I have a growing sheaf of printed out QR codes, and when I set up a new one, I just go through. It takes about a minute to say, here, sniff this, sniff this, sniff this, and then I'm good to go. And it's a one-way process. It makes much more sense to do it that way. Okay, so yesterday was the 44th anniversary of the invention of the Ethernet. And as I said, Bob Metcalf tweeted that Ethernet's 44th birthday is Monday. I sketched this, that is the diagram on the first page of our show notes, to include in a typed memo, he tweeted, on May 22nd, 1973 at the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. And so I just wanted to note, to give Bob some major props, because the Ethernet was a truly brilliant innovation. At the time, solutions involved some sort of centralized controller to negotiate access. There really was no good definition of a network. We were pre-network. And remember that the traditional mainframe and terminal model was that all the terminals would connect back to sort of a concentrator device, and so they would all have their own connections. But this whole concept of a inter-workstation network was new. Now, IBM had something known as the token ring. And the idea there was that you would literally have a ring topology, and works, and where workstations were connected, and the so-called token was like a baton, and so a workstation would hand the baton to the next workstation. If it had something it wanted to say or send, it would send it. And then it would hand the baton to the next workstation. If a workstation received this baton, then, and it did have nothing to say, it would immediately forward it to the next one. So this token would circulate around the network, and it was only the holder of the token could speak on the network. And so that sort of solved the contention problem. Well, it did solve the contention problem, but actually at a cost of great complexity. Because then what happens if a workstation hangs, as they used to back then, when it had the token? Now the token was lost, you know, like the baton being dropped. And so you needed some provision for token regeneration. You needed to all sorts of systems in place to deal with what happened when, wait, I'm not getting the token. Who has the token? And, you know, it really escalated. Bob's brilliance was to conceive of a network where all the peers, where everybody connected was a peer, and they were on a common backbone, a common ether. That is, so everybody could hear everybody else. And then he developed a brilliant and minimal simple logic. And that is, anybody that wants to speak listens, because everybody can hear, listens until nobody is speaking. Then they choose a random number, which is how long to wait before speaking. And if when that time is up, nobody is still speaking, they speak. And while they're speaking, they're also listening to see if anybody else happened by chance to start speaking at the exact same time. Because before you speak, you make sure nobody is. But there is a chance two people could both start at the same time. So if that happens, they will both hear the other, or all three of them, or all four of them, however many happen to try to speak at the same time. So they then choose another random number, which is how long to back off before retrying. And that's it. It allowed a simple logic to exist in every NIC, network interface controller, and it solved the problem. Everybody got to talk, and they all managed locally when they talked with a simple set of rules that they would obey, and the system worked. And that is the Ethernet we have today, whether it's a wireless Ethernet, which is Wi-Fi, or it's a wired Ethernet. That system was so good that it won. And the only problem, in the same way that the internet guys who developed packet switching realized, okay, this is not perfect, but it's good enough. That is, we're not going to guarantee packets. We're going to have this just sort of opportunistic routing. And on top of that will be a protocol that solves the problem that buffers may overflow, packets may get dropped, routers may go down, and so forth. Similarly, there's a problem with Ethernet, and that is as the amount of traffic on that particular Ethernet segment, that Ether backbone, whether it's wireless or wired, as the amount of traffic increases, think about what happens. At some point, everybody has too much to say. And so the incidence of collision, of packet collision, where two people are talking at the same time, increases. And so the efficiency of Ethernet falls, and to the point of failing, as you begin to approach the maximum actually well before you approach the theoretical maximum bandwidth of the system. So whereas IBM's token ring actually allowed you to closely approach much more of the maximum capacity, it did that at the cost of great complexity. Bob's breakthrough was being willing to sacrifice getting every last bit of bandwidth out of the Ethernet in turn for vastly simpler operation. And that was 44 years ago. Yesterday, May 22nd in 1973, as we were graduating from high school, Leo, that Bob came up with this.
Yes, he did. And a few years later, Esther Dyson got everybody together. I love these pictures. Is that next?
Yes. Yes.
A bunch
of people tweeted them to me for a reason that you'll see.
Yeah.
There's a young Bill Gates there, second from the left.
Gary Kildall. John Scully. I'm not sure who.
Scully, second from the right.
Yep. I'm wondering if that's Lee Felsenstein. I'm not sure. Guy in the Russian outfit is not Mitch Kapor.
Bricklin.
Dan Bricklin. That's right. Yeah.
Dan Bricklin.
And his buddy.
He dressed up that way, and Esther loved that.
He was Davy Crockett, it looks like.
Well, because he was a pioneer, and so he was dressed up as a pioneer. As a idea being that we're pioneering the PC industry.
This is Esther Dyson used to have an amazing conference release, or L1.0, and these are some pictures. There's Jobs and Scully.
Look how young Jobs was, and Scully.
Yep. This is fun. Who's
and,
that?
And there's Esther there, and there's Bill in the background.
Bill Gates, yeah, very young also. And wait a minute, who's that young fella? Who's that guy? This dark haired mustache.
Yep.
Steve Gibson. This is 1984, huh?
Yep. I was there with all those guys.
Were you there as a pioneer? What were you doing there?
I was on a panel, and I also was the keynote speaker on one of the mornings.
Nice.
So,
next to Mitch Kapor, Gary Kilgall
was
there.
Yep.
Wow. These are Esther's pictures. This is a lot of fun. It's bringing back some memories, some of these people.
Back in the day.
Back in the day.
So I have this week's groan-worthy riddle, and I apologize in advance. How did the WannaCry hackers get away?
I don't know, Steve. How did the WannaCry hackers get away?
They ran somewhere. Oof. Sorry.
Okay.
Okay. So Richard Romick sent me a nice tweet. He said, I have a quick SpinRite testimonial for you. Sorry if I make any Twitter faux pas, as this is the first time I have sent a message. And Richard, for what it's worth, you did a very nice job. He said, it started when my WD MyBook Live Duo NAS told me one of the drives were failing. While I don't have any reason to mistrust WD, I felt it was a conflict of interest when their device says, I need to buy a new WD hard drive. The NAS requires a specific line of WD hard drives to operate normally, he added. Therefore, I decided to SpinRite it. I grabbed an old Asus desktop computer out of the closet and happy to see that the motherboard reported smart statistics to SpinRite. I ran a level 2 SpinRite scan on it. The scan was all blue across the board, and the ECC statistics looked good, no red. However, when I stuck the hard drive back in the NAS and ran a long test, everything was good to go again. I'm guessing SpinRite performed some refreshing of the data it found hard to read, which the NAS had interpreted as the drive failing. I think that's exactly right, Richard. Thanks for the great product. I'm now running both drives on level 4 just to be even more sure. So, Richard, thank you for the note. And one one-liner from Barry Coggins, he wrote, laptop was running hot with loud fan speed. Ran SpinRite and all is well and quiet again. And, of course, we've seen that often. One of the things that happens is that people don't appreciate the amount of energy required to move the head. The head is accelerated and decelerated very fast. Well, that creates heat. And one of the things that people have noticed that is SpinRite sometimes causes their laptop to overheat because it's having to move the head as much. I expect that we're going to see 6.1 doesn't do that, because the head should move much more smoothly and uniformly, because it'll be reading 32 megabyte blocks at a time rather than 32 kbyte blocks at a time. So 1,000 times the amount of data per read, which the drives are optimized for, and should make things run not only much faster but also cooler. But in this case, if the drive was having a problem, it was having retries and rereads, causing its head to generate much more heat than the drive overall to consume much more power than it would otherwise. And running SpinRite fixed the read problems and cooled off the drive and allowed the laptop's fan to slow itself down and everything to run cooler, which, of course, we know is much healthier for computers. They don't like heat. And a couple of closing the loop comments from our listeners. Someone whose handle is MCEPL said, "Hi, Steve. Let me react in longer form." So this was a DM on SN612, last week's podcast. He says, "And your reflection on blaming the victim. I'm afraid that the advice you gave was so simplistic as to be dangerous. Yes, I can imagine that some MRI machine, completely air-gapped, really can run whatever archaeological, maybe he meant that. I thought he meant architectural, but maybe it means archaeological system one chooses. I understand that you, with some level of understanding of computer security, can run Windows 7 on your machine, although, as I recall, even you are now on supported Windows 7, aren't you?" No. I have that machine next to me. I haven't switched to it yet because I haven't been willing to accept the downtime it would take to move. I will eventually. "However, when we are talking about 90% of NHS computers, then I assume neither air gapping nor sophisticated use of computer can be assumed there. However, my biggest problem with this whole affair that I've been shouting to anyone whom I could talk to is the use of general purpose desktop oriented operating systems for everything, including things that are clearly inappropriate, like arrival departure monitors, Twitter status, and so forth, is crazy and should be stopped. Yes," he says, "I work for RHT, and that's Red Hat, right? "But I would never think that even RHEL would be a good idea to be used there. And it is way more modular, so it can be stripped down more. You don't even need a hard drive for such monitors, or they should be read-only. Just receive message via network and display it. Why do you need Internet Explorer, Notepad, and FreeCell for that?" For what it's worth, I am somewhat sympathetic to this. I do think that it is unfortunate that, you know, we see Windows error dialogues on marquees in Vegas and in the terminals in airports and popped up on ATMs. Unfortunately, it's a function of the fact that it is very easy to develop for Windows because of the, you know, huge array of tools that are prevalent. People are learning to program Windows. You can program Windows in any language that ever existed. So that's what ends up getting used. But I 100% agree that there are probably much more appropriate and less expensive and vastly more secure operating systems available. But they would cost more to actually deploy and to get out in the field. So that's not what's being done.
Actually, there was a rumor, I don't know if it was true, that the National Health Service in England was thinking of moving to Ubuntu. Which, you know,
that would be great.
It wouldn't be perfect, but it'd be less of a target, I would guess.
Yep,
than old Windows.
Bob Bowdoin, I think how I pronounce that. Sorry, Bob, if I mispronounce your name. Bob Bowdoin. He said, "Did you hang on to the minted bitcoins? Sure worth something now." And I did a little bit of follow-up. Of course, that's correct. They went north of $2,000 per Bitcoin over the weekend. And, of course, we've seen a 450% increase over the last couple years. It turns out, here's the math, which is somewhat distressing. Had any of us purchased $100 worth of Bitcoins 7 years ago, we would be sitting on $72.9 million today.
Whoa, that means Satoshi's rich.
Wow. Yes.
Wow.
7 years ago, $100 of Bitcoin is equivalent now to just shy of $73 million. Back then, let's see, the price was 0.003 cents on May 22nd, 2010. Wow. So
that's amazing. Just,
it is incredible. Bitcoin trading hit $2,185.89 in the early hours of Monday morning yesterday, hitting a fresh record high after it first cruised through the $2,000 barrier over the weekend, according to CoinDesk data. Yeah, so I guess Mark Thompson, minting in his garage, is feeling pretty good right now. Wow. Oh, and Costas Kritsilas said, Steve, in show 612, also last week, you were talking about the Android O restructuring and its similarity to Windows NT's HAL. You had some difficulty remembering the third architecture supported. I'm pretty sure, and he's right, it was DEX Alpha. And remember, I said Intel and MIPS and then Alpha. And then he says, in addition, later on, it supported PowerPC and Itanium, the latter two in Windows 2000. And then he says, later on, that was ARM. ETC Maryland said, at SGGRC, Windows S is not better because it's closed. It is still Windows and will not be secure. Just because an ecosystem is closed doesn't equal secure. And he says, if that was the case, then open source means less secure. It doesn't. And I would take issue with this. I disagree. I think that an operating system where the only applications that can be run on it are curated is absolutely more secure. Not perfect. We've seen examples where bad stuff gets through the Apple Store or gets onto the Android, you know, the Google Play Store. But as soon as that's known, those, you know, both of those closed ecosystems are able to respond. Contrast that to Windows, where anybody can and does download anything from anywhere. I mean, that is a formula for disaster. So I don't know if he misunderstood, but I think he's completely wrong. You're trading off a huge amount of convenience, the fact that you can't download anything you want from anywhere. But I would argue what you are getting in return is dramatically more security. And so, yeah, it does turn it into a limited toy as opposed to a radically open workstation. I choose the latter, but I think there's certainly a place for Windows S, for example, in the educational environment where you know, a browser and an editor, you know, an office suite, just a few things is all you really need, and not the kitchen sink that we have with Windows. I'm not going to be putting my apps there because I'm not going to be developing for the UWP system, but, you know, and it remains to be seen whether this succeeds or not, or whether Windows S is just another Windows phone. I got somebody tweeted a question from 609. How are all these people able to unlock others' iOS devices when after a few incorrect attempts, iOS enforces the passcode and wipes the device? And I tweeted to him, and I'll just share the answer here. The device must support some sort of fail count in non-volatile memory. So the people hacking phones, like the Celebrite folks that I assume he's talking about, take a snapshot of the non-volatile memory before they make their first guess. They then make the maximum number of failed guesses. Then they restore the snapshot, thus resetting the fail count to zero, and then make another round of guesses, then refresh the snapshot again, make another round of guesses. Essentially, that allows them to reset the fail count each time. And I'm absolutely sure Apple, and I haven't kept track of it, whether Apple already has implemented a fix for that or whether it's coming. But if it's not already in the hardware, you know it'll be in the next generation of hardware. Sassy Man Johnson is this Twitter's handle. Asked a question how from Security Now this week, which is last week. Says, how did folks get to the source code to WannaCry? Because, you know, we were talking about people, you know, like the malware tech guy finding this domain name in the quote source unquote. With almost without exception, everybody is using a beautiful tool known as the IDA disassembler. If you just Google IDA space disassembler, you'll find it. And it's a beautiful multi-platform tool for reverse engineering the compiled machine code of these exploits. So you drop it in there. This thing performs a static analysis, you know, finding jumps and breakpoints, identifying the tops of subroutines, breaking the code apart into all of the pieces, the individual pieces that originally formed it, and then showing how they interconnect and intercommunicate and link together. And where possible, it finds regions of memory that looks like strings and shows them to you as a string of text rather than as a series of bytes. So it does a whole lot of like the first level, first pass reverse engineering. And then somebody who understands this stuff is able to go in and look at what the code does, add labels and essentially further populate it with information from their own inspection. So IDA assembler, that is the go-to tool for this kind of forensic reverse engineering of code for which you do not have the source. You only grabbed a copy from a machine that got infected and you want to know what it does and how it works. And lastly, JC tweeted, I keep asking why NTP, the network time protocol, cannot be hacked. No response. Okay, I don't know if he's asking me or if he's just asking the ether, but he says, we're at a level that in theory it could. If not, why not? Podcast, please. And I'll just say, yes, it can be hacked. NTP is both a UDP and a TCP protocol, but typically it's just carried over UDP in the same way that DNS is because it's much faster. So it's not encrypted. It could be hacked, although it's not really clear what a hack of time would give you. Many things are like we were talking about certificates. If you lied about the date or time enough, then the certificate would be declared invalid, either not yet valid or now expired. So Kerberos technology is time-based, and there have been some hacks against it. But anyway, you know, it's certainly the case that you could play games with time, but we haven't run across we have run across exploitable NTP servers where the NTP service itself can be exploited, and we've discussed those. But you could certainly see an NTP response going by carrying the number of milliseconds since January 1st, 1970, and change that into something else, and the recipient would now believe it's the wrong time. But it's not clear that that gets you a huge advantage. So, yes, now you have a response. Can be hacked, maybe not worth bothering.
Aren't NNTP servers used for reflection and amplification attacks? I mean, the server itself has been hacked.
Yeah. Yep, that too.
Is that it?
We're done.
Nothing more you want to say?
613.
In the can, as they say. We do this show every Tuesday, about 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern, 20:30 UTC. If you want to come by on a Tuesday afternoon, it's a great way to spend the afternoon or evening, depending on where you are. You can also join us in the chat room at irc.twit.tv. But Steve, you know, he lives at grc.com. That's his website, the Gibson Research Corporation. Lots of stuff there, including, of course, SpinRight, world's finest hard drive and maintenance utility, and also this show. You can get audio of the show and handwritten, carefully contrived transcripts by Elaine Ferris at grc.com. We have audio and video at our website, twit.tv/SN for security now. And, of course, the best way is just, you know, subscribe. Find your favorite podcast application and search for Security Now and subscribe, because you want to collect the set. Just, you want all 613. You really, I'm not kidding you. You really do. You really
That's
do.
That's right.
And they're all available at Steve's site and my site. And actually, the feed itself only has the most recent 10, because otherwise the feed would be prohibitively large. You wouldn't want to download it every hour or so. We are a prime number, Steve. I'm being informed by Dr. Morbius in the chat room.
Nice.
Yeah. One but more of those, and you could have a key, a public key, a private key. Thank you, Steve. We'll see you next week on Security Now.
Thanks, my friend. Security.